the morning, rise into the street. Light me up that cigarette, and I strap shoes on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason things went wrong. Got to find a reason why my money's all gone.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome you all to Drive to HR, the number one internet daily radio show for the HR professionals. And I'm your host, Nisha, and I'm on your Twitter. Check it out, at the HR Buddy. And if you're listening to Drive to HR, give us a shout out by using the hashtag DTHR and let us know what you think. And if you have any questions to our guests, we would be able to pull that up. So as you all know, this month at Drive2HR, we are going to broadcast stories of failures and successes, and this is going to be a 45-minute show. So hang in there, tune in. We have a wonderful guest, Jim Knight. Jim, welcome back to Drive2HR.
Thanks so much, Nisha. I'm very excited.
Well, glad to have you here with us today, Jim, and it's been an honor to have you here with us. I know we have connected at Summer Brand Camp and Best Practice Conference, and at Drive-Thru HR, we have always had the pleasure of having you on the show and to talk more about culture that rocks and how to revolutionize your company culture. We love that.
Well, the pleasure's all mine. I know we missed each other at Summer Brain Camp this year, so it has been a while, but always have a great time whenever I'm with you, and certainly on Drive Through HR. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today.
Thank you. So, Jim, why don't you kick off the show? If there is anyone out there who doesn't know who you are, we would really appreciate if we can talk a little bit more about you.
Yeah, you know, my background really is in hospitality. I definitely went to school thinking I was going to be a rock and roll star. You know, I do have my music performance and education degree, but while I was there, I discovered that to really make a living, you had to be great. And I was not great. I was okay. And so I changed careers. I went into children's education. I was a middle school teacher for 6 years, starting off as a substitute teacher. And I took a summer job, really, at a Hard Rock cafe as a host. And my hair was very long. In fact, I just posted a throwback Thursday picture today, and people are throwing me under the bus today for my mullet. But I love that job. You know, I was really attracted to the brand, really the people, some of the most interesting collection of humans I'd ever seen on the planet. And I still have a mad crush on Hard Rock. I probably will forever, but that really set my career off. I worked for those guys for 21 years, running training for them and opening up properties around the world and just about anything you can think of. But it really set the stage for me to do what I'm doing now, which is I'm just a keynote speaker and now an author with my book, Culture That Rocks, and I have a consulting company on the side. So that's kind of the quick skinny. You know, I didn't think this was going to be my career, and my long and winding road took me to a different place, but it's exactly positioned where I needed to be.
You know what, Jim? It's been an amazing experience for me personally by hearing from fantastic authors, keynote speakers, and thought leaders like you, because everybody tells the same story, because initially you didn't know what's the purpose, or initially
at all.
You were in kind of a search that you said you knew that you was in that you were in that grade, but then eventually you kind of knew that this is what I have to do, or this is my gig, right?
Exactly.
So tell our audience, you know, some of the bad choices or decisions that you had made in the very beginning that helped you understand yourself, and then that helped you understand, no, this is not what I want to do, but there is something else that I want to do. And eventually that led you to make a decision of what you want to do.
Yeah, and, you know, probably the one that I mentioned the most, which is you think you're going to be one thing in life, and, you know, stuff happens. And you do a little self-discovery. Even when I talk about organizational cultures, I think we all have a personal culture, you know, and it's mm-hmm. the experiences and your own behaviors and everything we learn in our life. Everything is learned behaviors, the difference between us and the rest of the animal kingdom. I think you learn everything from school, from your friends, from your parents, from religion, from lack of religion, from the playground. You know, by the time you actually figure out what it is you're going to do or what you ultimately wind up doing, sometimes it's just a little bit different. And I would say maybe I guess I always wanted to be a performer. There's no doubt about that. I did a lot of musical theater. I tried to act. I wanted to sing, a little bit of dancing back in the day, which was not a pretty sight. But, you know, speaking is about as close to being, you know, a rock star, I guess, as I'll ever get. I still love being able to influence a group. And, you know, if that's the way that I can impact and influence a group of people or have a louder voice in the world, then that's my calling. And so maybe I didn't have the voice to sing, but I hopefully have the voice that I can influence and impact a group of people. So that was probably my first thing, is I had to be humble to just say, you know what, I'm not that spectacular in this one area, but I can use still my strengths and pull me over into another area. That would be one. I would say maybe another learning that I had early in my hard rock career, I was a pretty hardcore trainer. I did everything by the rules. I would give people some hardcore tests. Managers in training would show up, and if they were 5 minutes late, you know, I had the ability and the power, I guess, at that time to send people home. And, you know, on one hand, you want those brand standards and that level of scrutiny to be super high. But on the other hand, people have a lot of stuff going on in their life. And I wish maybe as a trainer I wasn't as hardcore, that I was a little bit more understanding, because you certainly couldn't get away with that now. And even when I used to do restaurant or hotel openings, when you're dealing with licensed or joint venture partners or franchisees, you don't have a stick as much as you have a carrot. I can't tell people what to do. There is no power out there. It's, you know, throwing your arms around people and loving on them and showing them the way, and hopefully they understand what it is you're trying to do. So I got my hand slapped a couple times when I was just sort of trying to exude my influence, and that was some growing up. I really had to learn some leadership lessons that it isn't about getting people to do the things you want them to do by force, but getting them to see a much bigger picture and influencing them enough that they would commit to it because they wanted to do it. So, you know, a little bit of a hard lesson during my early hard rock days, and certainly just my personal journey took me to a much better place than where I probably initially wanted it to go.
Great. And going back to one of your points, as you said, yes, I do agree, keynote is itself is a performance, right? Because we need to know how to deliver your story. It's all about storytelling and influence your crowd and, of course, embed the group of people that is in front of you. So
exactly.
I highly agree with you on that perspective. And about the learned behavior that you said, do you think, you know, people have the inherent ability to face failures irrespective of the way that they used to learn or be educated or be groomed? So what is that underlying factors when it comes to facing a failure?
Well, I think number one, I used the word humble, or being humble. You know, that humility factor is the first thing that somebody is going to have to embrace. It's probably the hardest thing for people that, you know, they definitely going to be more educated. They definitely probably have some experience, some exposure. That when they get to a certain level, and as you get older and as you have more experience, it's going to be hard for people to change their mind. And so I think that is probably one of the biggest obstacles, that people don't want to change their mind. They've already been through this before. They may even be thinking in their head, oh, I've already tried that before. That didn't work. Sometimes I think, you know, especially if stuff starts to go sideways, if your expectations of a process or some program or whatever it is you're focusing on doesn't go the way you want to, or it actually impacts you or your organization negatively, then you're going to have to learn to be humble, take some advice, think about things differently so that you can spin on a dime to get some wins out of whatever it is you were working on. So I think, you know, that's really, really hard for a lot of people, and I know it was for me. You know, even leading a team, thankfully I had really smart, cool people around me that challenged the status quo, and I was okay with that. But I would say even earlier in my career, you know, it's a hard thing to hear, and nobody wants to take a different approach. You know, so that's probably the first thing that I would think about, is that humility has to play a part, that you're going to realize you don't have all the smarts. Everybody is smarter than you about something. You want to try and capture that and put it into your noggin so that you can learn from those failures and just grow as a leader. Humility is a big part.
Absolutely. Well, talking about leadership, and you write and talk a lot about that cultural aspect and why a leader should embody that culture. So when it comes to that change management, yes, I do agree with you when it comes to people, if they are not interested in changing the way of the normal life that they have, or probably, let's say, moving outside of their comfort zone, or don't dare to take any changes when it need. So as from a leadership perspective, what are some of the aspects that you have seen that made them fail miserably when it comes to creating an organizational culture?
Well, I think when it comes to culture, if that's what your question is, a lot of times leaders, number one, don't either understand what organizational culture is, or they dismiss it. They dismiss its existence, and they know that it's true. Maybe there are some that have focused on things that are a little bit more metric-driven. So I give you an example. I've worked for many bosses before, and I know of a lot of them that still exist, which surprises me, that are purely focused on just the financial results. You know, they can easily look on a P&L and see if the organization is really doing well from a sales and obviously from a EBITDA, from a profit standpoint. But where they miss the boat is knowing that there are a lot of human behaviors that make those things happen. You know, for whatever reason, because there maybe isn't as good of a solid people P&L, and I would still say you can measure that in a lot of ways, whether it's turnover or employee morale or guest satisfaction scores, whatever it is, there are some things that maybe aren't as quantifiable, and so they tend not to pay as much attention to it. I think that's probably where a lot of leaders sort of get into trouble. And then you think about the broad swath of people that work, not just in you know, the industry that I've worked in, which is hospitality. I'd say in any industry, you've got middle managers out there who also then will take their cue from the leader, and things sort of run downhill. And so then they, unfortunately, although it might be important to them, they can't seem to get past that upper C-suite level ceiling if the leadership doesn't believe in it. But I do think managers at any level can absolutely make a difference. They can be a positive catalyst for change. They can also deal with failure and overcome it so that they can use whatever strengths they have to really change the culture for the positive. You know, I'm just a big fan of, you know, when the boss isn't around, when the leadership isn't around, you know, you can still control the culture. You know, I think a single person with a great idea can start a revolution. And, you know, for the culture to strengthen or ever get back to the good old days, we need managers and leaders to be brave enough to focus on the culture, not just the heritage. They need to speak out. They need to stay positive during change. They need to challenge the status quo and bring new ideas to the table. But I think your question, if it's focused on the leadership, if he or she at the very, very top doesn't get it, it's going to be harder for everybody else. But culture change can still absolutely happen. Unfortunately, I just think sometimes some of them just dismiss it because you can't see it. It's a nebulous, esoteric concept that sometimes you can't get your hands around it, and yet they get frustrated and start to throw down the culture card when things don't go right. If we could see it up front, it would just make the you know, whatever the financial results a little bit better.
Well, irrespective of whether the change is happening or not, communication is a key integral part of leadership, right? And you talk a lot about it in your book, and especially you highlight that with some examples like airline safety care and IKEA instruction, where the communication has to be so simple and accurate and in a language that your people dream. What can be some of the failures that leaders might do when it comes to communicating to their followers or to their people?
Well, you said it best. I mean, I think leaders, in a lot of ways, you know, there's a failure to communicate. They probably are just not spending the right amount of time or even the right amount of platforms to go and do that. So you were mentioning things like airline safety cards. I think of IKEA furniture instructions. I think Lego toys. You know, there's very little, if any, words in these pieces of training, and I look at that as training, at all. I mean, if there might be a word or two on the cover, and that's it. I grew up on comic books, so I always thought if I could try and deliver the exact same information but do it visually and remove the amount of words, geez, that would help people that have, you know, English as a second language, which we operated in when I was at Hard Rock. They were in some 55 countries and still are and growing. It would help people with learning disabilities or dyslexia. You would absolutely understand exactly what to do if you could put it all visually. And you can't do that on every page, but that would be my goal. I'd come with a visual approach. But then that's just, you know, in the print or the video or the e-learning. I also would think about the other types of communication. What can we do to communicate and get everybody in the organization on the same page? And if that means more all-staff meetings, more department meetings, more one-on-one meetings, you know, some of them are going to be formalized, like performance discussions or appraisals, but some of them are impromptu, and you just single out a couple people each day and spend some time understanding them, their hopes and fears, what's going on in their family, how much information can you provide to them so that they can be empowered to make decisions. My back at the house area would be an information superhighway, for crying out loud. I just say communicate, communicate, communicate. So it's exactly like you said, you know, communicate to them the language with which they dream. When they put their head on the pillow at night, how does he or she like to receive information? I bet it's in bullet point and white space and color and in the technology they've been using all day. We just focus on that, and you get people where they're in the know. Man, you're world beaters.
Well, now that we have tackled that communication part, how do we get our employees to talk about our brand? Or what do you see are some of the missteps that organizations are doing when it comes to getting their employees to talk about or represent their brand?
Well, obviously, if you get somebody who has just become a huge brand ambassador of the organization, it's an easier thing to do. I'm not sure you could force people to talk about you without you developing an atmosphere and environment that you can't get anywhere else. That people are just, you know, they're just in love with the brand, and you can easily take it from
it. It has to happen on its own.
Exactly. Exactly. I think if you try and force it, they're just not going to do it. You know, in fact, it might backfire and they'll talk negatively about you. I think it happens when you, and again, I'm putting on my HR hat here, I think if you were to focus on the things that matter to them, and it's not necessarily just the financial reward mechanisms, you know, it might have something to do with pay and benefits, but it's all the other things. It's how you treat them individually, and do they have some flexibility, and do they have a voice in the organization? Do you have some really cool, interesting reward and recognition processes? Some of them are going to be in front of their peers. Some of them might be on the side. You know, tenure is certainly something that's cool to look at. It's not enough. I think if you create such an environment that people love working there, boom, that in fact is that's your internal marketing. And that's where people will go out there kicking and screaming about how awesome the brand is. That not only helps out from a consumer standpoint, from a customer or guest putting some eyeballs on the organization, but then it starts to attract other really cool rock stars like these employees that want to come and work there. So for me, I think it's less of a tactic as much as it is a philosophy. It's an attitude that you have to go out there and create and say, once again, I'm going to love on these people. And this is the old service profit chain, you know, mentality. You treat your employees a certain way, so unbelievably great that they can't help but have that parlayed over to the consumer. And so that would be my focus. I would literally sit down as an HR professional, gather the team, and start thinking about every single area in the employee life cycle and think, what can I do to make the process so great that they can't help but think about these things as their day-to-day goes on, but certainly when they're out in the public domain? And that would be everything, how we hire and recruit and interview and ultimately onboard and train and develop. And you said communication and reward and recognize, you know, even in the way we separate from somebody could be done in such a way that people completely understand why they're being let go or maybe why they fired themselves. I still think there are people out there that have an affinity for some brand, even though maybe they left on bad terms because of the way that they were treated. And that is all about the leadership environment that we create. So a long answer to your question, but I think you can't go out there and purposefully have a tactic to create people who think about sharing the coolness of the organization. I think you have to do it with a total all-on onslaught of every area of the employee life cycle. And if you do that, then they're obviously going to talk about you positively, especially when they're working there.
Absolutely. And to add with that, if somebody is voluntarily leaving your organization or if they are letting go, you really want them to come back at some point. So
yeah,
exactly. And you want them to refer to great candidates too. So just keep that in mind. Well, Jim, we are almost halfway through right now, and I really wanted to give a shout out to our audience and do a brief intro. Well, everyone, we are doing Drive Through HR with our wonderful guest, Jim Knight, author of the book Culture That Rocks: How to Revolutionize Your Company's Culture. So check it out. It is available on Amazon.com and Kindle. So check it out, Culture That Rocks. And he is on Twitter, and his Twitter handle is @KnightSpeaker. That is KnightSpeaker. All right, so Jim, we kind of talked about the culture of the organization, the communication aspect, the leadership aspect. And one of the interesting things that I really wanted to get your thought is about the differentiation. You know, one of the points that you talked in your book is people crave differentiation. So from an organizational perspective, you cannot do it just for the sake of doing it, right? Because if you are going to do it, it has to be unique, that is suitable to the organization, that is suitable to the culture of your organization, and especially suitable to the customers you are going to serve. But have you had a chance to go through any of the organization or probably any clients that had taken any missteps when it comes to strategizing that differentiation factor and miserably failed?
I'm not sure if I've worked with any that have failed. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I think many of them have focused a lot on their heritage, on the way that they've always done things. And, you know, that certainly comes to mind quite a bit. Whenever I'm in front of a group, you know, because culture, out of all the topics that I might do, is definitely my number one topic. So although that resonates with audiences, sometimes when they put me in front of a group that has been around for a while, it does make them a little bit nervous, because here I am trying to bring something a little bit different. I'm trying to get them to resonate with the here and now and how both consumers and employees are expecting organizations to operate. And where I think I see maybe some, I'm not sure I would call them failures, I would just say they haven't been able to move with the change. You know, and everybody, as we talked about, hates change. They do. And if they've been around for a while and maybe they've been very, very successful, nobody wants to take the leap to start thinking about things differently. But what they don't understand is that if they don't change, they're gonna hate extinction. You know, not being around isn't fun. And so I think a lot of times organizations get really, really caught up in the past and the way that they've always done it. And there is definitely a difference between heritage and culture. Heritage, which is, mm-hmm. you know, about the past. It's about the way we've always done it. You know, and some companies have killer great, I guess, stories. They've got great histories. And people love that. They love nostalgia. I personally am attracted to companies that have a great story, that have a great history, a great heritage. But the new people, you know, they care about the here and now. They care about what is happening to them and what's going to happen in the future. So that's where organizational culture comes in. I just think it's a collection of individual people. They each have these individual behaviors, like we talked about. Some are awesome, some are not so good. When you have a collection of people, you know, whoever's in your company right now, that's your culture, that's your organization, not just the past. So I recognize it. I celebrate it. I think a lot of organizations that are failing maybe to just sort of change with the times or adjust their organization a little bit. And again, it's all because of people. But I think they're going to struggle. And every time somebody joins or leaves their band, you know, their brand, if you will, the culture changes. And so that was part of the reason that I speak about a lot and ultimately writing the book is I wanted to make a concerted effort to separate the two, to get the audience to not really get wrapped up in the past, the way that it's always been done. You can celebrate heritage. You can recognize it. You can use it to your advantage. You can love on it. But companies have to focus on the current culture. And that's, you know, it's a living organism of unique behaviors. So I can't think of one company to really answer your question. I do think a lot of them just sort of get stuck in the rut of the way they've always done things. And hopefully I can be a catalyst to come in and think about things differently.
Absolutely, and I'm sure they would love to have you, and they are doing a successful job right now. So talking about culture, and one of the points that you said in your book is about treating your own employees like they are volunteers. Love
yes.
the ones you are with. So tell our audience a little bit more about how should an organization treat their employees if they are volunteers.
Well, I think if you, you know, it's really just sort of an analogy, but I do think about, let's say, nonprofit organizations, or if you think about joining some voluntary organization in your local community, think about the language and the way that people treat each other. There's nobody that has any power there. You have no bullets in your gun, if you will. You hear nothing all day long but please and thank you and can you do me a favor and you're awesome and you rock, you know. It's a much different mentality. And I think if we sort of took that same approach and sort of thought, what if I converted every single one of your employees today into volunteers? They didn't have to be there. You don't have any power over them. There's no power of the purse. It literally is. They're showing up because they want to. My question would you treat them differently? And, you know, some people, they might think to themselves, no, I'm pretty good. I would treat them exactly the way I always treat them. But I think in our heart of hearts, you would have to think, yes, I definitely would treat them a little bit differently because I'd have to say please or thank you more or whatever it is. So I think people do a fairly good job, but every once in a while you still have a leader out there or a so-called leader who likes to manage through threats and punishment and fear and, you know, they try and muscle the result. That doesn't work anymore. And so I'm constantly in these, sometimes it's an entire industry approach, but sometimes I'm trying to get in front of people to say, listen, those days are gone. You've got to think differently about the organization, how we treat them. And one person can, unfortunately, make a huge difference if that's how they're going to behave. Because if I'm a rock star employee, I don't need you as much as you need me. I hate to say it out loud, but it's the truth. It's an employee's world right now. The rock stars can always get another gig. They can always go and find something else down the road. So if it's a really good employee, that old school sort of management, that authoritative approach isn't going to work. We ought to treat people and behave and act like they're volunteers. Because they are. I mean, they can go wherever they want to now. So I just sort of, there might be some other things that I'll do and I'm actually facilitating to sort of lead to that point. But it definitely, if I'm getting to where we can talk about people-oriented behaviors and how that leads to business metrics, I'm coming with the treat people like volunteers mindset. You do that and things start to you know, get to a much different place than just trying to muscle the result all the time.
Absolutely. Well, I like working as a volunteer and then working for a nonprofit wherein we are working for a cause, right? We all are working together for a cause, not just for that monetary value itself, but it's all about bringing people together and then working together in a manner that makes a big impact in others' lives. So give your employees an opportunity to become a volunteer within your organization itself. That's what Jim says. So Jim, next point that I wanted to really highlight from your book is about hire rock stars. not just lip syncers. You know, I really love that word lip syncers, because when you hire somebody, it's not just about for the paycheck alone, or it's not just for completing that competency alone, but it's for the culture of the organization. It's for the team, and it's for the service that you do to your own customers, right? And most of all, you really want them to represent your brand. So what are your tips and techniques for our audience when it comes to hiring the rock stars?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the book and when I'm speaking, and mostly because of the background, I'm going to use a lot of music orientation, a lot of band and brand analogies, and hopefully that resonates with people. I think I wanted to make...
It is. That is the best thing that I love about your presentation.
You do? Oh, well, see, it's working. That's great. I wanted to be sort of edutaining, if you will. You know, I wanted to be edutainment at its best, a little bit of fun with sort of this glaze of rock and roll over the top, but seriously meaty takeaways for people. And, you know, ultimately, depending on how much time I have in front of a group, and certainly in the book, because you can go a lot deeper, I do talk about the employees. And I think a company is only as good as the care and the attention that we give to make sure that every single associate or team member has what I call the three C's. They've got solid competence, you know, that they can do the job, you know, or at least they're going to get about it quick, even if they don't have any experience when they come on board. The second C is character. They've got strong character. They're not trying to do silly things behind your back and steal from you and disrupt the harmony of what you're trying to do. You know, those are hard to see sometimes in an interview, but you can see when somebody has the right character for your company. And then the last C is actually the cultural part. You know, they represent the culture. So what I love for people to have competence, character, and culture when they come through the door and there's a right fit, I would. I just know that great brands maybe don't focus on the competence part anymore as much. They're so focused on the character and the culture piece. And so I make the analogy of rock stars, the ones that you would love to have all three, but at the very least, these are your best employees. These are kind of like you were saying before, they were brand ambassadors. They're talking about you positively out in the public or internally, and they get other people to sort of think the same way. And I make the analogy to the Rolling Stones, you know, the rock and roll band, arguably one of the greatest bands of all time. Great music, great musicianship. Although they haven't had a hit song since 1989, you know, haven't had a hit song in 2.5 decades, but when they go on the road, they make more money than anybody else. So if you were interested in buying an album or downloading digitally the entire thing, you're going to spend some money, you know, $12, $16, whatever it is. But getting tickets to a concert is way hard to do these days. Sometimes I've seen they start at like $175, but there are some VIP tickets that will go up to like $2,500. But people are still willing to spend that money. You know, they if you could be at the show of a Rolling Stones concert, it is absolutely priceless. And the point that I make on all that is people are willing to pay the price for the show because of the show. You know, it's because of the employee. They want to see Keith and Mick do their thing at 72 years old. They don't even want to hear any of the new stuff. They want to hear Satisfaction. They want to see them go out there and bring the rock and roll thunder. So, you know, I spend quite a bit of time, if I've got an opportunity, to talk about rock stars. And you know who they are. They're your top talent. They're out there in the public domain. You might have to mine for them. You might have to seek a little bit harder to go and find them. But when you can find them, they make the organization happen. You know, what we're trying to avoid are the lip syncers. You know, the people that just, you know, they flap their gums. They're going through the motions. They put in the bare minimum. You know, they're only working their 8-hour shift, just looking for an opportunity to punch the time clock and get out. You know, I can't stand lip syncers. When people are just going through the motions, they will be discovered. You know, they will be unmasked at some point, and everybody knows it. You know, and you'll never, ever, ever be able to rekindle your career once you're discovered to be a lip syncer. Just, you know, ask Milli Vanilli. They'll never, ever be able to come back because people will discover them right away. So me personally, if I was a leader in the organization, I would be on the hunt looking for a rock star. And if I've got some internally in my organization, I'll do anything to get them to stay with me, anything.
Absolutely. And by being a rock star, you are doing a service for yourself itself, because you are improving your own career, not just doing a work for somebody else just to earn the paycheck. So
yep, I agree.
Jim, another point that you always talk about, great leaders produce great leaders and create promotable people, right? So tell our audience why it is so important to create promotable people.
Yeah, and when I use that word promotable, it is the right word that I want to use. I think some people get confused saying, I want to hire people that, you know, for the sole purpose of getting to the next level. And what I'm really trying to say there is I want people to be ready to take on more responsibilities, whatever that is. In my world, you know, we had non-tipped employees who wanted to be a tipped employee. They wanted to make gratuities. They wanted to be a server and make some money. And so if you start off at one position, the only way that you have any hope to get to that next one is to actually prove yourself. And so there are some things that we can do to help them get there, and part of it's going to have to be on the back of the employee to say, I want to get to that next level. I want to be promotable. So there are some things that they could do. So in that case, it's one position to another. It might be that they're a staff member and they want to be a manager. Maybe they're a manager and they want to be a GM. For me, it doesn't matter. I'm a busser who has forks and I'm trying to get the spoons. Whatever that next level is, my whole point is that leaders can help them do that. We could, number one, not, I think I want to use the word hoard information. You know, you keep all this information close to your vest. No. I'm the boss. I'll let you know, need to know basis. You know, if you do that, then you're going to shut people down, particularly the millennials and the next generation. I call them the digital natives. They need to be in the know. You can't just sort of bark out orders. You're going to have to share a little bit more liberally and get people once again on the same song sheet. And we talked about communication earlier. I think part of it is teaching people how to fish, you know, giving them the why behind the what. Instead of telling them exactly what you want to do, which is a good start, if you explain to them or let them help, you know, help them, I guess, come up with the solution themselves, you're probably more likely to not have the same issue arise. And so if there are some programs, some processes, some discussions that I could do to get someone to be completely ready, it doesn't guarantee the promotion. It doesn't guarantee, you know, they're going to get the next level. But I certainly will probably look at them first versus having to go on the outside of the organization. So there's this perfect scenario that everybody's always looking for. How many people do you hire internally versus going to the outside? I don't know what that perfect percentage is. I've seen companies do almost 90% on the outside, and then, you know, your culture will probably take a little bit of a hit. I've seen them do almost all the hire internally, and you never have any new, fresh ideas, and you're stagnant. So you want to have a balance of the two. But my point would always be you should be in a place that you decide you want to go to the outside to hire, not that you have to, because you should have a great bench, a AAA ball club just waiting to fill in the ranks. You would love to be able to do that so that you can perpetuate the culture of the brand. So, you know, I use that analogy of Jack Welch at GE, former chairman of GE, you know, absolutely known for promoting people. I think everybody that ever reported directly to him ultimately became a president or CEO of some major company. You know, I think he, at the end of his career there, when he was stepping away from GE, he had three people that were eligible that were direct reports of his. And one of them ultimately took the job itself. And the other one became president and CEO of 3M, and the other one became CEO of Home Depot. So he was all about getting people to take on more responsibility so that they were ready to jump in when the need arises. So I would be on the hunt if I was back in operations or if I owned a company that had employees. I would be looking for opportunities. What could I do to help people connect the dots to learn information and to be completely ready to go when the time arises?
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining with us at Drive-Thru HR, and it's been an honor to have you on the show and to hear more about the insights from your book. Well, we have about 5 minutes left at this point, and I really, really want to ask this question. It can be a blunt question, but our audience would get a lot of information and insights from you. Well, tell me about a decision or a time that you regret in your career, and how did you overcome that?
Well, I at one point, that doesn't scare me at all. I at one time became a telemarketer. I got on the phone to sell people prepaid credit cards. At the same time, my dad had talked me into selling pool supply, chemical pool supply. It was called sodium bromide, which actually put an electric current into the water, which apparently people say is very safe and healthy, and it's great. But I never sold a single one of those. I never sold any of the sodium bromide, and I never sold any, you know, prepaid credit cards. And the whole time that I was doing it, I realized hardcore direct sales, which I have great, great friends who can do that, is not a love for me. And I probably wasted an entire summer doing both of those jobs. And I'm so thankful that sales was not my calling. I believe in it big time. I think I wanted to be below the surface, not dealing directly with the customers, but really focusing on the people who, you know, if we're going to market and sell and scream at the top of our lungs about how awesome a brand is, I wanted to have people then check out the brand, and I would be responsible for putting people in their sphere that they could create the experience, you know, that it wouldn't be a waste of marketing dollars and sales effort. So I realized right away my calling was not going to be in sales, and I failed miserably at both of those. But that was also part of my personal culture. I think I discovered myself pretty quick that was not going to be the gig for me.
That's great. And what is your success mantra?
What is my what?
What is your success mantra? What is that, let's say, one single aspect that you always keep, irrespective of the situation that comes into in front of you, that you've always tackled that with this particular thought?
You know, I think for me, it's always going to be this positive mentality that I'm about to step into a situation where I'll affect, you know, X number of people. It could be a small group or a large one. If I'm in front of 4,000 to 9,000 people, I really have to think positively. I at the end of this hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever we're going to be spending, that it is going to positively affect people. I just constantly am thinking, I can't wait for people to hear the things that I'm about to say, or in my book, you know, the things they're about to read. Whether that's true or not, in my mind, I just absolutely love that performance art, which is where we started the conversation, saying, here's what I hope people get out of it. And, you know, hopefully it'll resonate with them, and we'll have a few laughs and yucks along the way, but they're going to walk away with something tangible, meaty to make their lives better. Usually their business lives. I mean, the book is certainly a how-to business book, but I want to be able to be a part of that. And I want people to refer back to that and say, he was the guy. That was the nugget that I needed to get my business from here to there. So I, you know, for me, it's all about thinking positively. I can't wait to get in front of as many people as possible to have a voice to help them with their brands.
Absolutely. Well, I've been at least 3 or 4 session of yours, and always there is something to learn, not something like everything to learn from you, but there is always something new that I've always captured in each and every session of yours. So I really, really appreciate that.
I appreciate that.
So thank you. Well, Jim, tell our audience where can they connect with you, find out more details about your book, and where they can find you.
So it's probably online. They can certainly go to my speaking site, which I'll have a lot of information and videos and testimonials and things like that, at nightspeaker.com. Like you said at the beginning, it's K-N-I-G-H-T, speaker.com. They can also go, the name of the book is Culture That Rocks, so they can go to culturethatrocks.com. And if they're just looking to just grab the book and they don't need any of that background information, they can just go to Amazon and grab it from there. So 3 places to grab the book. But if you want to know a little bit more about me, certainly nightspeaker.com is the place to go. And, you know, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. I play in all the social media places. I believe in professionalization. My friend Jason Seiden gave me that word. So my personal and professional lives are all mixed together. So I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn, and probably Twitter is the platform I use the most, which is at Night Speaker. So any of those will work out, and I appreciate the opportunity to sort of throw those out there if people are interested.
All right. Well, thanks, Gene, for joining with us. Have a wonderful rest of the day, and we will talk soon.
Sounds great. You guys rock. See you later.
Thanks. Bye-bye.